afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. And just to clear up that little disclaimer at the beginning, we're not actually broadcasting for entertainment purposes. That we just throw that in so you'll keep listening. But we're broadcasting for educational purposes, especially today. The shows on South Africa are for educational purposes. There. But you still can't blame the station for it if you don't like what we say. I guess you could call and yell at us. You can find all our information at wethepeopleradio.us and got our phone numbers on there and everything else, email, phone numbers. So, you know, don't feel like you can't reach out and communicate.
There you go.
So I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard up in Shasta Lake City, just north of Redding. And you can reach them at 530-226-9226 or get them on the web at readingtractors.com. .com. Yeah. So, yeah, anything tractors, give them a call. They got some great deals up there, and they can do the service, order your parts. The whole shooting match. So give them a call.
And if you've never owned a tractor and you need one, it's a good place to go get educated.
There you are.
Doesn't Bill sound relaxed?
Yeah, I'm pretty
Bill's relaxed. Bill's
yeah.
on vacation. Bill's been on vacation for a week. Actually, we left town and everything.
Yeah.
Left town. We went to the happiest place on earth. 43 square miles.
It was a little sweaty, but it was very relaxing.
It was extraordinarily sweaty. Yeah. In Florida, sunny Florida. But, you know, before we left, I did say when I come back, I put all the fans in the house away, packed them all up, put them away. I said, when I come back, we're going to have fall. And you know what? It's like 60-something degrees today.
Yeah.
I was sort of kidding, but not really.
No, it's beautiful.
Apparently, I control the weather, and I didn't know that. So next year, we won't be having 115-degree summers. I'll get on this program a little earlier.
Yeah. I'll put my order in.
Yeah, no kidding. All righty. So our guest today is Dr. Harry Buyens, and he is a PhD defense and aerospace physicist from the Cold War era. He has a 360-year bloodline in South Africa, so his history dates back that far. And I guess I'd kind of stack that up against anybody's genealogy. I don't know a lot of people who've traced their ancestors back that far, but he has lived there for 47 years and is very well versed in the issues that are facing the folks there today. This is installment number 7 in our South Africa series. That's just 7 different weeks. Not all of those were 2-hour shows, but they are all archived for you at wethepeopleradio.us, and you can get them all there commercial free. And all of the information that he cites, any of the video clips that are played, the actual video clips are listed there for you so you can see them, since obviously this goes out initially on radio. But if you go to your computer and want to look it up, it's all there for you.
A lot of good information that he's posted.
You don't have to believe us. Because if it was for entertainment purposes, we would not give you any information.
No.
And then you would just have to believe us. But this is actually factual, so you can go do your homework. It's a whole new idea. We're hoping it catches on in the media. You know, actual factual information
Facts.
Going out to people where they can verify it themselves and are encouraged to do so. Rather than browbeaten and belittled into believing them. So, yeah, please don't believe us. You should believe Harry, but yeah, go check him out. He has a terrific blog, by the way, that we did not promote really at the beginning. But his website is cliffwoodfog.com, and it's CLIFF Wood, WOOD, and it's Fog, FOGGE.com. A little tricky on the spelling. And from there, you can find his blog. It's H. Buyens, BOOYENS, .wordpress.com. And he's a terrific writer, all terribly current. On today's issues and a lot of history, so you get to learn about current events with a really good historical framework. Something that we don't get a lot of these days. All right. That said, back to you, Harry.
Thank you, Harry. I hope Bill has forgiven me for the Georgie Schwartz question.
We're having some sort of messages from NASA are coming through. No, that's not it. That was on that ride we were on at Disney World. That's different, but we are going to have to listen to the little tape feed come through. So keep going and ignore that.
Okay. So what I would like to do is, you know, connecting it to current U.S. situations, I need to explain that my people in South Africa are probably very well described, even though we don't have Walmart in South Africa. We can be very well described as smelly Walmart people in mostly flyover country, another country where the liberals cling to the coast, and we cling to our guns and our Bibles, and we don't care that you refer to us like that. So we understand mostly the people who live sort of from within 50 miles of the coast to 50 miles from the other coast in the U.S. I find that I can walk through any door in the U.S. and speak to any of those folks as though I've lived there all my life. So we're the same people. It's just the guys on the coast are weird. Something to do with the water, I think. Now, how can people like that want to, how might they want to go back to the French philosophers of the 1700s? And I'm going to show that to you. And part of this is that I have a great love of history. And I know that folks are often taught history in a horribly boring fashion, like you have to remember a bunch of names and a bunch of dates, and then somewhere in between some inane professor comes along or teacher and asks you, when was the war 1812, you know? So I want to go back to around 1782. At that time in France, you had these new French philosophers who were talking about, they weren't using these words, but the Brits put these words in their mouth, and it's an adequate description. They talked about the noble savage, that somehow the, quote, civilized, unquote, Western man was tainted, and the, quote, noble savage was noble no matter how many people he killed or what depravity he committed. And somehow, it is only when that depraved white man arrived somewhere near the savage that the savage somehow, remarkably, turns into some horrendous, horrible person. So it must be the effect of this Western guy, this Western Christian. He's corrupting everything he touches, right? That was their philosophy. The sheer stupidity of it is just galactic. But here is an example of one of those Frenchmen traveling the bush in South Africa in 1782. This little pearl of insight from a Frenchman called Lavelin. He says, in every part, that's fancy English for place, in every part where the natives live entirely unconnected with whites, their manners are mild and amiable. In other words, when we whites don't see them, they're very nice people. Whenever we don't see them, in other words, unconnected with the whites, their manners are mild and amiable. Now, you can think what I'm thinking as a scientist when I read that. Okay, yeah. So everything's good when I can't see it. Great. Okay.
Totally, you know, scientific.
Is there a sound when a tree falls in a forest and there's
exactly.
No one there? Okay. On the contrary, he says, an acquaintance with Europeans alters and corrupts their natural character, which, amazingly, he actually puts in the word amazingly. Yeah, sure as hell it's amazing. Which amazingly degenerates. And this remark, which is a melancholy truth, seldom admits of an exception. I cannot begin to tell you the scientific stupidity in that paragraph.
Wow.
Actually, the use of the word science in that...
It's come full circle, because that's just about what's going on today.
And
that's why I wanted to read it to you, because I was part of what I want to convey to you guys is we had a president in South Africa during the Second World War, the one where the concentration camps were invented.
Hold that thought, Harry, so we don't have to cut it in half. Let's take a really quick break, and then we'll have a straight shot at that. We're going to be right back with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. We are discussing South Africa, and you are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Choosing your battle, pick yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front fire, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's on, you feel it, but you got it all, believe it. When you fold it up, oh, oh, and if you fold it up, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. It's time for Africa.
Okay, I like the little soccer song. I just think it's fun. Okay, that's our only fun song today. Back to the left.
So we were talking about the insanity of it all.
Where the insanity arises.
Exactly. So go ahead and pick it up where you left off.
Right. So I've quoted you guys that little bit that the Frenchman Lavallée wrote about the African bush in 1780. Well, he wrote it in 1790, but he was traveling through the bush in 1782. Things took some time to do back then. So I wrote in my book, if you allow me to quote just one short paragraph, I said, it is striking that this representative of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's noble savage school of thought would write this drivel even as the black Amakosa were killing one another in droves a few miles away from where he was. The present half-blind, psychotic, guilt-based behavior on the part of Western man therefore comes a long way and appears to have been born in the minds of the 18th century French philosophers. It remains intriguing how much the 18th century philosophers could expound on the nobility of savages without ever meeting one.
Yeah, because that would have just messed up the whole program.
Yeah. Now, he was not the philosopher. He just bought their story. The philosophers sat in France. Okay, the closest they ever got to a savage was one of them who went to Tahiti. Not exactly the African bush.
No, not exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's so, like we were at Epcot, now, but that doesn't mean we really went to Morocco.
So now, in my efforts to make history interesting, so, you know, there you hear what the French were thinking back then, and I gave you a real Frenchman on a horse in the bush in Africa, in his own words, and I'll give you the reference where you can read it, what he wrote. It's not my words, it's his. Now, by 1783, a year later, 80% of Britain's economy was still based on the slave trade. 80% of Britain's economy was based on the slave trade. Britain was the main slave trading nation. Don't let them give you any other BS, okay? They had completely taken that over from the Portuguese, long time before. So, given that they had championed the cause of slavery, and given that they had now lost America, okay, they now convinced themselves that Africa was where they had to go and atone to be absolved. Their Prime Minister, William Pitt, joined their national lament on 2 April 1792 in their parliament. Now, the following quote is in one of these great British books of greatest ever speeches, you know, in the history of man. Well, I grew up in Africa. I read it for what it really is. So here's what he said. Remember, this is 1792, which is just 9 years after their slavery peaked at 80% of their economy. He wrote, or he spoke in Parliament and said, quote, How shall we hope to obtain? Let me stop. How do I put on a voice like that lady Ford who accused Kavanaugh? I need to figure out how to put on that voice.
Yeah.
None of us can actually tell me how to put on that voice.
I need that now. How shall we hope to obtain, if it be possible, forgiveness from heaven, capital letter, for the enormous evils we have committed, if we refuse to make use of those means which the mercy of providence has still reserved for us for wiping away the shame and guilt with which we are now covered? Okay. Fair. Leave it in that book. Inscribe it on a statue. Call him William Pitt and shove it on a plinth, you know, and don't take his statue down. Great. Well, I have a couple of suggestions for what they could have done. They could have sailed back to America, offered you many millions, and bought the slaves back from you and then freed them, maybe. They could have gone and put them back, or the children back where they found them in the first place. But no, that was going to cost money, you see. So what they really want to do is make, like certain American political parties, stand in what was then the British Parliament, thump their chests, bring out sacks of ash, rend their hair, and lament before man and God about how terrible they have been. And then, to make up for all of that, they are going to go not to where they got slaves in Africa. They were not going to go where the slave trading happened. They are going to take their little rear ends to the one place in Africa where no slaves were ever taken. Cape Town, South Africa. They send the London Missionary Society. And that's when all our trouble started. So I want to now just play you a little mental piece here that comes from back across on the continent of Europe in 1791, a year before that speech by Pitt. There was a water spout, of all things, on the River Meuse. Now, I don't think there are too many water spouts usually in Europe because the weather doesn't get that rotational. But it takes places like the U.S. to develop water spouts and tornadoes and so forth. But there was a water spout on the River Meuse. And it so happened that it ran over a little rowing boat on that river. And in that rowing boat was a man called Johannes Theodorus van der Kemp with his wife and his daughter. And the boat was overturned. And Johannes Theodorus van der Kemp saw his wife and daughter die in that accident. He made it out. His life went to pieces. He went back to his Dutch Reformed religion. And then he found out a couple of years later about the creation of that London Missionary Society. And this broken man then joined the London Missionary Society to become the man who was inflicted on South Africa in the year 1800 as the first representative of the London Missionary Society. Now, I promised I would make history interesting because ultimately sending him there led to the finding of the source of the River Nile because, you see, Livingston
was a later
member of that operation. Okay. And had just as weird a history, but one is not allowed to say that because he's an untouchable hero, so you shouldn't let facts intrude. You know, facts are a terrible thing. The problem with scientists like me is this is probably why Leonardo da Vinci was you know, run out of town in Italy because he dared to speak the truth. Anyway, Van der Kemp, now there was a character for you, okay? This guy arrives over there with a commission to go and preach to the black people under King Gaika on this extremely volatile frontier of that colony between white and black. He, in the middle of a war, wants the help of people to get to the black King Gaika. So he joins a wagon train of Afrikaner ancestors of my wife. They are fleeing the frontier, going into some of the uncharted territory, not totally uncharted by, but really away from the black people, further into the interior. They flee. And they're doing so in a wagon train with all their guns and their powder and all of that. So they say to Van der Kemp, sure, you can join us. And then when the Imidange Xhosa, the bad ones, so to speak, attack, Van der Kemp sits on the wagon, gives his gun, old blunderbuss, gives it to some of his coy helpers. They have to do the shooting, and he sits there and says, I have no fight with those people.
Wow.
Interesting character. So his rear end has to be protected by everybody else around him while he professes a higher level of understanding of humanity and loyalty. You cannot tell me that you haven't seen some of those creatures in your political woodwork in the last few years.
No, we don't.
Whichever way the wind blows.
So, well, I found him particularly useful because my people were not exactly, you know, riddled with guys writing diaries at the time, and he kept a diary. So I found a lot of the evidence for what I'm saying in his own diary, which is kind of fascinating. Now, I can go into a whole story there, but that's going to take away all our time. So all I'm going to say is that he ended up failing with the black people, so he returned to the Cape and decided, tell you what, I'm going to stay here at the Cape, but I'm now going to minister to the Khoi people instead of the black people. And soon enough, as soon as he got in there, he explained to them that they were oppressed, they were really badly off. You should watch out for these Republicans. Oh, sorry. Okay, right?
You accidentally did fast forward into reality.
Yeah, sorry. It's just, you need to understand what goes through my head when I watch the U.S. television.
Oh, I bet.
I get the whole history of South Africa runs like a continuous reel through my head, and I just want to rip my hair out of my head saying, wake up, boys. Do I have to come down there and tell you reality? Anyway, so he eventually came back, ministered to the Khoi people for whom he created mission stations, and eventually the people from those mission stations were called in to build the scaffold to hang my family. Okay?
Huh.
Interesting. Mission station people used to build the scaffold. How do you like that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but that's a whole other story for another day. And again, I don't want to sidetrack myself too badly. Let the history lapse for a while there, and just you can understand with that little bit I put in there that my folks were not thrilled with the London Missionary Society or their particular missionary. There were several others. The Wesleyans were okay. Even the Catholic Church came later, but the Anglicans came. They had trouble with the Anglicans, but not much. They had no problem with the Wesleyans, etc., etc. I'm going to hold it there just for a minute, and then get a break in.
Because through the magic of the Skype text box, we just communicated.
There you go.
In the last half hour of the show, we've gotten it all together.
We finally figured it out.
I didn't want people to think we were just all of a sudden just, you know, super good at this. So you're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. And remember, this show's about education. The entertainment's just a little thing we throw in for fun.
As I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
It's kissing the day.
There we go.
You know, we mentioned earlier we were on vacation the last couple of weeks, and a couple of the programs...
For the first time in 12 years, let's point that out.
Yeah, let's point that out.
We finally
broke down and got away from it all. But one program in particular we attended was about American history, and from our conception till current day. And it's interesting how our history turned out, because we defeated the British, and the similarity, or what it could have been had we not won that war and ended up under British rule. I think we'd be looking at the same thing you're looking at right now, Harry.
Well, that's a cue for me, Bill, to just quickly grab a piece of paper I wanted to use in a previous show and just ask you these quick questions.
Nice job, Bill.
What would Americans have done if, number one, the British governor of the United States, sorry, of America, had written a letter to London stating that he wanted to create a Mohawk army to intimidate the citizenry? That's with apologies to the Mohawks. I have nothing against them.
Mm-hmm. You can pick somebody.
I just picked someone. What if he had disarmed the farmers on the frontier and half the colonial territory was lost to a consequent massed Indian attack of combined tribes on the 13 colonies or combined nations?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What if British missionaries in America told London that the farmers were murdering indigenous Indians and the king instituted a circuit court to hear these cases? No one was found guilty because the missionaries had willfully lied. And that is what the magistrates found, by the way.
Yeah.
What if, in the wake of those hearings, your ancestral brother was accused of mistreating an Indian, refused to turn up at court, given the history of the previous point, was shot dead in response by Indians in British Army uniform under British command, the above army having been indeed formed by the governor?
Yeah.
What if his brother swore revenge, was caught and hanged with four more men, and the citizens of the district were forced by the governor's Mohawk army to watch? What if four of the ropes broke, but the magistrate simply redid the hanging in front of the distressed relatives? What if that rebellion had been planned on your family's farm? What if the massed armies of Indians invaded the colony and killed your family, and the governor realized it was now war and he had to fight the Indians, and the government in London announced that you were the problem, fired the governor, and gave back the Indians the land the governor's army had just taken, thereby placing the invaders on your doorstep again, always considering the invaders had bypassed the British army post to attack the civilians? What if, in response, you started the great trek into the unknown west of America simply to get away from British authority, packed up your family and your belongings and your family Bible, sometimes even your family piano, on an ox wagon and trundled off into the unknown west at 20 miles a day because anything was better than any more imperial British rule? What if 40 of you were attacked by 5,000 battle-crazed warriors who had never lost a battle and you had to fight from your wagon circle? What if you survived that against all odds and then attacked the offenders, driving them north some 400 miles? Okay? And then found, I kid you not, an American missionary serving among them, and he chooses to rather come home with you and baptizes your family. And he creates, wait for it, the Dutch Reformed Church in the new territory. That is my family history.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
It's this kind of thing that caused me to write the book, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What if 100 of your party made proper contract with a savage king for land, had a British missionary draw up the contract, secured the king's cross, the signature, in front of witnesses, okay? And your guys delivered the side of the bargain, and they were then killed and impaled by that king. 100 of them.
Yep.
What if that savage king sent his army to massacre the women and children who had stayed behind, cutting the babies from the mothers' bodies? 400 of the folks died.
Oh.
Okay? So that is the history of South Africa. Now, on another day, I can go into all of that. I'm going to just simply bypass that and go straight to the media. Because what preceded this great trek into the east to get away, into your west, if you wish, in parallel, our northeast, what precipitated it was a war in 1835, and by that stage, this London Missionary Society had created a pressure group in London. The boss of this mission, his daughter married the owner of the biggest newspaper in Cape Town. And that newspaper launched into all the white people on the frontier. So this is like the New York Times on the coast, okay? Only it was called the Commercial Advertiser. Launching into these folks who are fighting for their lives on the Tennessee border. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, not Tennessee. I meant the Great Fish River in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And there is nothing the guys on that border can do. Here is what a notary public in frustration wrote in his own book about what was going on. He says, biased in favor of the black people, deeply prejudiced against the colonists, every evidence on behalf of the latter, however respectable or trustworthy, was unheeded, while the wildest and most extravagant denunciations against them were favorably entertained. And even its very report was entrusted to be drawn up by the Reverend Dr. Philip, now the leader of that mission, the least principled and bitterest accuser of the colonists, a person to serve his purpose did not hesitate in one case to suppress and in another interpolate whole passages in public papers made by the committee, besides being guilty of the most shameless fabrications. You know, over this weekend, I was thinking of this quote, and I was sitting on my bed yelling, "We are all Kavanaugh now."
Yeah.
So I wrote here, the fervor with which Philip and his London supporters went about destroying the character of the governor, the military leader, the settlers, the Afrikaners, absolutely knew no bound. Okay. Eventually, he confessed his true prejudice against his own blood in a letter to the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. Here is the boss of the London Missionary Society in South Africa in the 1830s, 40s, saying about his own people, "I consider the black people on the border of this colony as most decidedly superior to that portion of the refuse of English society that find their way to this country."
Wow.
They were smelly Walmart people, were they not?
Yeah, not mixing any words there.
Okay, so like I said, I come from a long line of smelly Walmart people. I proudly shop at Walmart. My only objection is I wish they would stop selling me Chinese rubbish.
Yeah, there is that.
But that's all. Other than that, the people I meet there are perfectly fine. No problem. Okay. So I wanted to share with you that bit out of the 1830s. History marches on, gets fascinating, and it can all be summarized in one or two sentences which boil down to, wherever my guys went, the British would follow soon with cannon and navy. And they would always, always, always use the words of those missionaries, even when that missionary organization was fundamentally destroyed. They would still use its line of thinking. Sorry. They would still continue to say that my folks were slavers, did all kinds of terrible stuff, presumably looking for us behind the door where they themselves were standing. I mean, it was the British who had perfected the slave trade, doing their triangular trade, slave route. Taking slaves in Africa, selling them in America, taking American goods, selling it in Britain, and taking Britain manufactured goods and selling it in Africa. They had that triangular thing with a rule that said, don't bring the merchandise home. That is why the slaves were not taken to Britain. The merchandise was not supposed to come home. Okay? That phrase was even used by my own mother when she explained why she couldn't bring certain books home because the company policy was, quote, don't bring the merchandise home. So that history rolls forward with my little lot being chased all over southern Africa. As soon as they had won a major battle against some party, the Brits would come and take it all. And the excuse would always, always, always be that my folks are slavers. So always, always, the British government looked for us behind the door where they themselves were standing.
Right.
And And they used that, for example, to take the western part of what is now the Orange Free State province, because apparently our guys wanted to do slavery only where the diamonds were.
Yeah.
Oh,
what a coincidence.
Yeah.
As soon as there were, oil was not yet the big deal. Diamonds were a big deal. So, as soon as the diamonds were found, our guys were practicing slavery there, and Britain had to go and save the poor people. The fact that the Brits then moved them out and shipped them elsewhere in the African bush is not remembered. That way, they then had the diamonds, you see? And the same happened with the gold and so forth. So that pattern repeats over and over. And that is why if you speak to an Afrikaner like me, and someone tells me that they're concerned about the human rights of ABC over there, I question everything.
Bill's having a little spaz attack with his phone over here.
Okay. Now, I want
Pardon that musical interlude.
I want to jump through a whole bunch of history that follows. I'm going to go right past the Great Boer War and all of that kind of stuff and take you deep into the 20th century.
All right. Let's take
into
a
more contemporary history.
We'll take our final break and then we'll come back and do that. Meanwhile, we'll turn Bill's phone off. Oh, you're listening to We the People. We're here with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouillons. We'll be right back. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. So in our final, like, 12 minutes or whatever, what would you like to leave people with?
Well,
no pressure or anything.
I would like to just quickly cover that late 1800s or middle-late 1800s piece of history because it's so important to the who stole the land issue. And I'd like to point out when all these folks set off north in their ox wagons to get away from the British, they ended up making a proper deal with a captain, a chief called Makawana of the Batong tribe in what is now the Orange Free State province. And he sold a huge tract of land to them based on that deal. And the deal consisted of, please give me so many head of cattle and protect me against Mtsilikazi of the Matabele tribe. And so my ancestors went off. And when the a little bit further north, and when the Matabele attacked our guys, it was that fight that I described earlier in that thought experiment about an alternative United States. Having driven off the Matabele but lost all their cattle, they got help from another black chief who stayed friends for all of his life. And then they set off to go and attack Mtsilikazi, and they drove the Matabele, Mtsilikazi and his Matabele, out of South Africa all the way into Zimbabwe, where they became the Ndebele tribe of Zimbabwe, the people who were murdered out so badly by Mugabe, 40,000 of them killed by Mugabe. Okay? They were no longer in South Africa. Our guys argued that, well, the area vacated by them is now rightfully ours. And it is in that area where much of the dispute of South Africa is happening, because the people who were originally driven out by Mtsilikazi came back in and said, hey, excuse us, but this is originally our home. We want it back now. Thank you. Thank you for defeating him, and please go away. Okay? So The South African history and how things went with the black tribes is rather different from the Indian one. It's not as though you had an endless series of wars. You had sequences of treaties and then consolidation of things and sometimes things done in bad faith and so forth. And you had a trail of tears and all that kind of stuff. We don't have that history. We have a history of straight up and down fights. And a history of actual deals made. The land in the province of Natal on the coast was formally bought from that king who then killed our guys. The land between the two major rivers was formally bought. The eastern half came with a fight with the Sotho people, but they're not the main instigators of the farming trouble at the moment. And they have their own country anyway. And then to the far north in South Africa is the one area where I would say black people have a legitimate argument about some of that land was always theirs and should be respected. And I would back them up on that. But to say that the central government is simply going to go and take property away from white people because they are white, come on, you know, where does that come from?
It comes from the communist playbook.
Yeah. So the problem for us now is that while that was the history of South Africa, this school of thought that I call the beast, this London Missionary Society beast, that started dominating the press, not only in London, well, in South Africa, but certainly in London. And from there, it was exported to the United States. And that is how it came about that the New York Times, during the time of the concentration camps in South Africa, reported, as I already said on another show, reported that the ladies in the concentration camps can play tennis all day. And if you don't watch that, I'll send you the link to the New York Times article where they say that.
Wow.
Okay? So there's an entire school of thought. I call it the body of the beast. And you're up against that thing. And you saw it in operation over the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Absolutely saw it in operation. That beast took us down in South Africa. Okay? There's no way we could keep standing with the U.S. implementing weapon sanctions against us and then complete universal sanctions, etc. We had no hope in hell. However, when you start getting freedom of information releases of documents, you read stuff like this. Here is Henry Kissinger in the mid-1970s when he asked us to go into Angola to help the United States. Quote, "There is an African sentiment, admittedly only in private, but probably more extensive than we know, which accepts the necessity of South Africa's balancing intervention if a Soviet victory is to be prevented and the military balance necessary to achieve political compromise is to be maintained." That's fancy diplomatic speak. How about I quote you the notes made by Bob Ingersoll, who was then the Deputy Secretary of State, 19 December 1975. Okay, freedom of information results. "The key to keeping our side in Angola from collapsing is South Africa. As far as the Africans are concerned, they would agree to have South Africa clean up Angola. But we could not pay the domestic price in this country." And there it is. There's the beast. Africa was okay. Africa came and asked our help to go in there against the Russians and the Cubans. The problem was not the Russians. The problem was not the Cubans. The problem was not the Angolans we were struggling against. It was not the Angolans we were supporting. It was not the black nations who came and asked us for help. The problem was the left wing in America. I read again. "But we couldn't pay the domestic price in this country." In my book, I say Ingersoll was proven correct. The problem lay not in Africa. It lay distinctly in the United States. The beast breeds in your media, guys.
Ugh.
Okay?
We're sorry.
When your Deputy Secretary of State writes the truth in the margin of a formal Security Council meeting, which is what this was, Okay? When your state president at the time, 10 years later, writes, this is Reagan, 1985, South Africa is not a totalitarian society. There's a vigorous opposition press, outspoken protest, and access to international media that would never be possible in any part of Africa or in the Soviet Union, for that matter. That's a press meeting in the Oval Office, 10:30 a.m., September the 9th, 1985. But that was no good. Your Congress decided to overturn his veto of sanctions against South Africa. And when that happened, it was the same thing as your bank tearing, you know, calling up your mortgage, ripping up your mortgage line of credit, and snipping up all your credit cards. That's us.
Mm-hmm.
We lost the farm. Thanks to your Congress of that period. Both in 75, when they implemented the Clark Amendment and caused us to be deserted in the face of the enemy, and secondly, in 1985, 86, when they passed comprehensive sanctions against South Africa, that is when the ANC tasted blood in the water and they went for the jugular. And of course, when Bill Clinton came in, he backed them. It was all over. We're dead. I am dead man walking. I represent the last of the Mohicans. This is how you die, guys. Not with a bang, but with a bloody whimper. Okay? And you can thank your media. Okay? May God help you that they don't take your country down, because they are busy succeeding.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, they would like to, and I think they've got plans for that. And
they'll never stop. They'll never stop. Doesn't matter how many times we punch back, they'll never stop.
You know, the one thing you can count on with them, though, is they always go too far. They go too far too fast. And then it's enough for people to go, wait a minute, that doesn't actually make sense.
So I trust you've heard me clearly that I acknowledge that in some parts of South Africa, black people have a very solid case for claiming that there be something done about land. But to make it a blanket statement about all of South Africa is just plain evil and racist.
And then to go in and kill people to try to drive them off their land and intimidate them.
I don't even know how to begin, saying how wrong that is.
Yeah, there's no excuse for that. I don't care what happens.
You know, and then I, having written stuff like this, I have to sit down in front of my TV and I see the same monster that destroyed us go after people like President Trump and Judge Kavanaugh.
Trump's really the first guy in a lot of years who has, done anything that was helpful, it sounds like.
Yeah.
For South Africa.
Yeah. Well, I mean, while I liked Reagan, you know that Reagan was eventually buried by a South African, right? His church minister was a South African.
Did not know that.
Okay, go check it out. He was a South African church minister for Reagan. I heard the accent and I thought, what? What am I hearing?
You're like, I must know that guy.
And so I did the homework, and yes, he was South African. He died more recently.
Interesting.
But so far, President Trump is the one who has more specifically done something. Nothing Reagan did really helped much in the end. But what President Trump did help. You finally have a president who is not, forgive the phrase.
Your spaceship is ready.
At least, your president is not gesticulately challenged like your Republican Party.
So, although they've stepped up, which is kind of nice.
We have an expression in Afrikaans that says "ja broer," which means "yes brother." The kind of guys who sit in a chorus and when somebody speaks at a political rally, they go "yes, yes, 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 yes brother, yes, yes, yes." They're called "yes brothers."
Oh, well, we've got some of those. Hey, we've got to run away again, but I'm sure we'll chat soon. And so
thank you.
Thanks a million.
Thanks for coming
for
on,
all the
Harry.
Great information.
We'll get together again shortly, I'm sure.
Keep us.
Because this is an ongoing
posted
story.
And three cheers for South Africa. You guys hang in there. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Until next week.